let's start there. What was it like when you first came out to the Minidoka Project?
Well, it was a barren desert. That's all. And the people who came could take up claims, and they were called tree claims, because we were to plant trees to change the desert-looking condition. And they had to build a little shack, a house, and which really was nothing more than little shacks of boards, they could get them, and plant trees around. They could not do like they did back in Nebraska and Kansas, make them out of soddies. They were not sod houses because there wasn't any sod on the Minidoka Project to use. They had to be, and the logs had to be hauled in from other places, and they were required to plant trees on the property that they took.
And so this all is what your brother did when he came out. He went and he took up a homestead and built a house and planted trees.
Yes, that's what he did. And then also, he, you see, there, at that time they were just beginning to put in the irrigation. Minidoka Project was the big thing in irrigation. And they were just putting up the dam to hold the water and to dig the ditches for irrigation, because it was ditch irrigation, not overhead. Now I'm sure that they do a lot of overhead irrigation. They did the last time I was there, which was years ago. And he had a team of extra nice horses, and he helped to dig the irrigation ditches on the Minidoka Project. And that was in 1904, 5, and 6.
Did he know what he was getting into when he decided to come out? And then, did he know it was going to be a desert where he was going to live?
I don't know about that. I believe that he had been in Alaska before that and had looked around for gold before that and didn't find it, and so came down. And that was a big thing. They were encouraging people to come and settle there so that it would be profitable, so it would be worthwhile to put the water on the project.
So what made you decide to go out there yourself?
From Nebraska, where I was teaching, because they were there, because both my brothers were there at that time. And one of my brothers died and was buried there near Paul. And I came out to keep house for them. That was what I was supposed to do. But then instead, what teachers were needed, so I went over to Albion and took the state teacher's examination, passed it, and began teaching school. And the people I lived with, the names were Iverson. He was from Denmark. He had come from Denmark. And that was about a mile and a half from where the schoolhouse was. So I rode horseback always in the winter. Always rode horseback to school. I might say something about the school, I guess. It was a rural school, all 8 grades, and altogether there I had enrolled 50 pupils altogether, with an attendance of 35.
What happened to the other 15?
Oh, they dropped out. They were too large to go to school. Work took them away and things like that. And you might think it was absolutely impossible to teach anyone under those conditions. Well, this is the way I arranged it, the way I did. The older students, as soon as they had finished their classwork, so that they had their class for tomorrow, for the next day, I should say, then they could... they could take the little ones, take these... they could take the little ones and hear them reading or help them with their math work or something like that. And so they were very anxious to do that. Every eighth grader wanted to be able to help someone else in the lower grades in school. That was an honor, that was a privilege. And they were doing something, and so they were all eager and anxious to do that. And that way we did. School begun at 9 o'clock. School closed at 4 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning. School closed at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. If all the work was done, and if it ran over 15 minutes, there wasn't too much arguing about it, but never more than that. Never more than that. But if they had failed in their schoolwork, so that they weren't didn't have their work done, or maybe missed too many words in spelling or something like that, then they stayed after school until they finished their work or had their work done, or had their spelling completed, or something of that sort. They could be kept after school for 30 minutes without any question being asked. But if it was kept longer than 30 minutes, then they complained. Parents would complain about that. So they really took their books home and studied at home to have their classwork ready for the next day.
So you think it worked, and you think the kids learned pretty well that way?
Definitely, I think they did. I think the mere fact that if they had their work all done, that they could help the little ones in the first, second, or third grade. They could hear their spelling. They could take them over the clear in the farther corner of the room. All of this, you understand, is in one large room. You understand that, with a big pot-bellied stove in the center of the room for heat in the wintertime. Well, if Mary had her work finished so that she knew she was ready for tomorrow, she could take some of these little ones over there in that farther corner so that it wouldn't be bothering the class recitation over here, and help them with their spelling or with their arithmetic or whatever.
Did you have to work with each kid individually, or did you try to work with groups of kids?
Groups. Yes, but sometimes it was necessary to work individually, of course. And the arithmetic, and on Friday afternoons, I hadn't thought of it for some time, after recess, there was special in. We had spelling every Friday afternoon. There was spelling down and arithmetic, ciphering down. It was called ciphering down, which they went to the board, and some of them was, a book was taken, and the teacher said, "This book contains 340 pages. Now, where is my finger? What page would you say my finger was?" The person who thought that he had nearest to where her finger was got to be the one to go to the board first, and then he could select someone in the room to figure down with him. And the one who was chosen could decide what they were going to figure, whether it was going to be addition, multiplication, subtraction, division, fractions, or common fractions, or decimal fractions. And of course, when they got in the eighth grade, then it was square root. Still had that on junior high now, but they have it in problems in square root or something of that sort. Now that was on a Friday afternoon, ciphering down or spelling down and so forth. That was
spelling down is a spelling bee where the kids take turns trying to spell words. Is that how
Yes, spell down it was called. Was done in different ways, usually two lines. Two lines. Johnny, he guessed the nearest page in the book so he could go over there, and Mary was the next, so she had over there. Well, Mary could choose someone for her side, Johnny could choose someone for his side, until everyone was chosen and stood in two lines on the floor to begin their spelling.
Did the leader pick everyone on his side?
Yes. Yes, he picked everyone. Johnny over here, mm-hmm. but he just could choose one, and then Mary chose one, and Johnny won, and Mary won, and mm-hmm. so forth, back and forth like that, until everyone was...
So Friday you played games. That was the fun day.
Yeah, that was the fun day. And then once a month, we had a program. Pieces to speak and songs, special songs, and that was most of them. Sometimes little dialogues or little plays. That was once a month. But Friday afternoon was a play afternoon when they could do something different, and they could select what they wanted to cipher down or to spell down.
Did you have trouble keeping order at all? Were there ever did the kids give you a hard time? Did they play pranks? Did they test and see how far they could go, what they could get away with?
Well, I might say yes, but they didn't. I was such a cross person that they couldn't get away with very much, and they knew it. No, I was very severe. I was very, and I feel to this day that I was justified in being severe. That I, and those days, while I didn't resort to that sort of thing, they could switch children with a branch of a tree. Give them a good switching for being unruly or disobeying orders and so forth. And oft times the rules and regulations were written on the blackboard so that there wouldn't be any question about whether they had. And what
would those typically be? What were your rules in the classroom? What did you expect the kids to not to do?
Whispering. Or leaving your seat without permission, leaving the room without permission, that was prohibited, you couldn't do that. You could not even go and get a drink of water without permission. And no whispering. You see, that about, take 30 people in the room, they all began to whisper, what could you have? Chaos. No, never any speaking out loud. How
would you discipline the kids when they gave you trouble?
Well, sometimes they stood in the corner with their face against the wall. They were disgraced. It was a disgrace to be punished. But that was one way. If they couldn't behave in their seat, they could stand in that corner until they could behave. And if they were too disturbing, they stayed after school. They were too disturbing.
Do you think that it was harder for a woman to be a teacher than a man in those days? I know there were a lot of men teachers too.
Well, quite a few.
As far as keeping the kids in order, in line.
Yes, I think so, because the mere size of the man. And the fact that he was a man. I think that they were more less unruly, I'll say it that way, than with a woman. But of course, I can't judge from the others because, as I said, I was very severe. I was, I felt that I had to, because you're not going to learn the, now nowadays they do, I understand. They can have talking in a room. But I felt then that they couldn't, that we had to have order, we had to have it quiet, so that everyone would not, so that no one would be observed, be troubled, or what do I want to say, interrupted in their work, so that they could have it quiet while they were studying. And recitations were always done. See, the school building, the schoolroom was large, and the children, the seats were back, so that up near the teacher's desk was a large bench on which they, a fifth grade sat when they came up to read. They turn, stand, pass. That was what they had to do. They could turn from their seat, they could stand by their seat, and then they passed up to this recitation bench. That's what was called, a recitation bench. And then they sat up near the teachers so that they would not disturb with their reading or with their talking or so forth, would not disturb the rest of the students, see.
So they recited just to you?
Yes, yes, definitely. Yes, they're... recitation was done just for the teacher up there, and as low as it could be, so that as not to disturb the rest of the room.
Did you decide about passing the kids from grade to grade? Was there much ever much question, or would you just pass a kid on each year, or was it severely graded, like
severely graded, very much so? He had to pass a certain examination, a required examination, and the state of Nebraska and the state of Washington sent out state questions that was to be asked of them from the what we'd call junior high now, grades.
What about Idaho?
Well, and Idaho
did too.
Yes, that. They sent out these questions that the pupil was, must be able to answer them correctly to pass from one grade to another, and to pass from the eighth grade so as to go into high school. The state sent out lists of questions that had to be answered, written answers. And these were sent to the county superintendent, who the teacher could grade them, but the questions had, or the answers had to be sent in to the county superintendent, who had the last word in whether they should go from the eighth grade into high school. I'm talking about rural schools, you understand.
Right.
And that was true, too, in when I taught in Benkelman, Nebraska, in intermediate grades.
What did you think of the fact that, did you think that most of these kids were not going to be going on? As I understand it, in the rural schools in the old days, an eighth grade education was considered pretty good.
It was, and a very great deal was made about it. And the last day of school, we had an eighth grade graduation class, and a picnic, and he received an eighth grade diploma, which was like a big envelope, you know, an eighth grade diploma that he was through with the eighth grade. Yes, a big thing was made of it. And girls had lovely new dresses for this occasion, and so forth. Might have been they'd been in the seventh and eighth grade for 2 years, each grade maybe. But they finished the eighth grade. And it was a big day. The last day of school was a big day for these students who passed the examinations, county and state examinations. So they.
Do you think that the examinations that they had to pass pretty much contained or summed up what they did need to know to be able to get along in practical life skills after graduation? Or were there other things that you felt they had to learn and you taught
them?
Well,
they naturally, automatically learned a great deal of other things. Yes, I do. I think that in many respects they were qualified to cope with situations that they found outside every bit as well as, and I have done substitute teaching here in law school, as well as some are today. Yes, I do. They were older chronologically, you see. As a rule, they were older chronologically than what they are today. And I think that makes a difference.
Why is that? Because they started later or it took them longer?
Well, yes, they were longer. Maybe they'd be 2 years in the eighth grade before they finished. They had to go to school, keep going to school, you see. That was the main thing. Parents wanted their children to go to school. And if they had to be 2 years in that grade, all right, then they were 2 years.
That wasn't a disgrace to the,
no,
to the kid to go in the same grade?
No, no. No, it was not. So
think that they did learn by the time they were done to be out of school? What out of the eighth grade? What would you know about what? How much could you do by the time you were done?
Well, now you mean in the way of school or in the way of making a living, or
well, I mean in the way of schooling. With the should they be able to read a regular adult book? Would that be what they were expected to be able to do?
Well, I had them read the papers, the newspapers, and we had every week for our civics class to bring in something from the papers that they felt that was applicable to certain situations, be able to distinguish what was beneficial for reading and not trash. Well, what do you have today for that you want to bring to the class or the school? What did you find? And they were proud to bring something that they felt was worthwhile. They read for a purpose. They read the papers for a purpose. And I will say that I checked here some material that was sent to me just last week, that there was less trash and less obscene material in the papers in those days than what there is today. I think that is one of the worst charges that we can have against our TV and against the papers is some of the almost obscene material that is in the papers and on TV. They just got a letter here. How do you feel about TV? What do you what can you do to clean up TV, to take the set question off the airways? Have the material right here, and I got ready and sent some of it away because I believe it should be.
What would your civics class study? Did you look at current issues?
We studied the Constitution of the United States. The first thing they did was to learn the preamble of the Constitution. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, secure domestic tranquility, and provide for the comma, defense, do ordain and establish this form of government for the Constitution of the United States. Yes, that's one of the first things that they learned. Yes, we studied the Constitution, and then the state constitution, more limitedly than the United States Constitution.
Which grade did this? Was this the 8th grade? Or?
Yes. Sometime dropped down to 7th. 8th grade, junior high.
Was this after the study of American history, or was this the study of American history?
Well, it was neither. It was along with it. You see, history begins down in the 3rd or 4th grade. You know, we begin studying history there, but do not get into the details as we do with go over. But no, that was a part. That was the civics class, and the history class were two different classes, but they were studying, and they studied the Constitution of the United States. Called Constitution, that was the name of the class in some schools.
Did you do much of what would now be called current events when they go and say, well, this is what's going on in the country, we have this question, this problem?
Well, absolutely. That's what I say, wouldn't it? That's what we brought in, what they brought in. What do you have? What do you have now in the current events? It was called current events often, too. What did you find that you have to tell the rest of the class or to tell the school about what's going on?
Would the kids discuss it with each other as the boy may, after you made you presented what you had to say? Was there discussion allowed?
Limitedly. You must realize that in a school like that, where the other classes had to be respected, there just wasn't too much time for things like for class discussion. You realize that the classes were for discussion time was limited often to 10 minutes apiece, and you can't do too much in that.
You mean 10 minutes for each class?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, where you have so many in one room and so many different classes for the day, there isn't enough minutes to have.
Would the civics class, let's say, meet in one corner of the room, and so that they could read what they had to say to themselves and not bother the other classes or the other kids, or did they read to the whole class, to everyone in the room?
Well, if they brought something, a clipping from the paper, that was brought to class and read, or the teacher read it to them, you know, and now maybe a few minutes of discussion on that. But or it could be or passed around silently during study period. During study period, you see. But we had a civics book, you see, to study as well as current events. Current events is once a week. I usually had current events in the morning to begin the day with the opening as part of the opening exercise. Once a week, at least, I had the current events for the part of the opening exercise in the school. And that could be discussed, and, you know, what do you have today? Did you have, you know, hear a hand up over here, what was it that you had that you wanted for today? And that was part of the opening exercise.
While the older kids were doing this, the younger kids would be studying on their own.
They'd be listening.
Listening to
it. Yes. For opening exercises, everybody participated.
But when your history class met, and history class got together and those kids talked, and or you talked to them, then the other kids would do their own homework at that time.
Well, do their own study work. They'd be studying for their next class, don't you see?
Yes.
They'd be studying for their next class while the teacher had the recitation bench was always up near the teacher's desk, of course, so that they would be separated and would not be interrupting the students at their own desk. And by the way, the desk when I was going to school, and then too some after I began teaching, the seats and desks were large enough so that two could sit in the in each seat. And then when the school became and the room was large enough so that each one could have an individual seat, that was something, you know. That was something to have. Why, it has individual seats. That was something. Didn't have that back in the Minidoka Project.
Didn't.
No, they sat in two seats.
What were the facilities? There we go.
Now, in some schools, they furnish the books for the pupils. In others, the pupils had to furnish their own, pay for their own, bring their own books. And, of course, if the school district was furnishing them, the books were kept from year to year and would be pretty well worn out by the time they were through with. But that was done in some cases. For the school district furnished the books, and sometimes the parents had to furnish the books, depending on the money available to the school district.
And what was it like at Minidoka, in so far as the facilities like that? Did the kids have enough books and enough materials?
They, in the way of pencils and tablets and so forth, they had to furnish their own. Their composition, their tablets, their pencils, things, they had to furnish their own at that time. I was in one school where the school district furnished a limited amount so that each child had a tablet and a pencil to begin school. And that's all that was furnished to them for the school. And others had other schools, they didn't even have that. So they had to bring their own pencils, tablets, and so forth. And of course, for the school district furnished the books, well, they had to last, and would be pretty well worn out by the time. They were kept in the school room from one year to another until they were used up, worn out and used up.
There's one more question I think I have about the school, and that is, did grades double up? I mean, would you have, if you were, say, studying American history, would you have 7th and 8th graders study it together? Or if you were studying arithmetic, would you have maybe the 3rd and 4th graders and 5th graders studying together so you could have more kids in a group?
No.
You must have had a lot of classes then.
There were a number. That's the reason I say 10 minutes for a class recitation would, in many cases, average. No, because one child that's in the second, there are exceptions, you understand, to all these rules, that a child in the second grade could not read in a third grade book. Otherwise, he'd be in the third grade, see. Sometimes they were able to do that, be able to read better than what they could understand, and to read an arithmetic problem, for example, and understand it sufficiently to be able to solve the problem. And then many times in some of those old spellers, there was a combination of English and spelling words. For example, here would be this list of 10 to 12 spelling words up here. And below that row of spelling words would be a paragraph with blanks ever so often. Now, fill in the correct blank with the word from up above here. See, a combination of English and spelling. That was done in some books.
When you say recitation now, do you mean that for one kid or for the whole class, the whole subject? You say 10 minutes recitation. Does that mean 10 minutes for the civics class?
There are 6 pupils in the. In that geography studying, and we called it geography. There were 10, I should say, there were 10 pupils in there. And we would have 10 minutes for a period of about the reciting on that geography lesson that they had spent, we hope, an hour studying. And
10 minutes each?
Huh?
10 minutes for each kid?
No, ten minutes for all
of
them.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. So, quickly, Mary, what's the capital of Mississippi? She forgot. What's the capital of Florida?
Tallahassee.
See? If they could answer quickly, then it went to someone else. No, no one had 10 minutes time to answer these questions. Each one, no. Maybe there'd be only 10 minutes time for the entire class recitation of geography or science or whatnot.
How much did you have to prepare for these classes?
Well, I definitely always knew what it was, yet we had a teacher's class book, and that was open to the county superintendent. She came along, "May I see your class book?" It was a book in which the teacher kept note of every, not only of all the pupils that were in school, not only all of those in the different classes, arranged class, but also the work that they were accomplishing on the 15th day of January. What did they have in social science? And what did they have, what were they studying in spelling? And what were they having in arithmetic? It was a large book, and teachers had to have her record there, so the county superintendent came along. Why, I'm speaking about these rural schools, not city schools, town school. And that the teacher had her book and all of her classes outlined and what they're going to do on a certain day. Yes, she'd work until 12 o'clock many a time to have all the work ready for everyone for the next day. Page 15 or page 27, one question on page 27. Jimmy, what was that? Will you read that question and give the answer, please? Like that. Yes, the teacher kept her outline book, her class book.
As you've taught through the years, how do you feel that the methods and have changed as you taught, say, and the difference between the way the schools were in 1930 as opposed to 1910, and then 1950 as opposed to 1930. What kind of change have you seen?
Well, yes, indeed there has been a change. And I will say this, I don't think it's all been for the best. I do notice, I've done substitute teaching over here in Moscow schools since I've been here. It's in the last 10 years, and in some respects, yes, of course it's better, it should be, but in some things, I'll tell you, 50 years ago, it was a great deal memory work, they memorized. And I think that's a pretty good thing. But there wasn't the time to put in to working out and figuring out and making propositions and so forth as there is now. And that, I think, is a great that condition which exists today is much to be commended over strict memorization. But that's what it was years ago. Memorization was the big thing. And, well, there just wasn't time for guidance, for anyone to be guiding them, everyone in or to be able to help them to work out some of the big problems that they have today, too, that they can today.
What problems are you referring to?
Well, things that, given a certain condition, existing condition, what would you do? How would you go about solving that condition? There wasn't, there just couldn't be so much of that, those at that time, as there is time for now. And for, of course, I haven't been teaching regularly there. I haven't had it kept a teacher's book now for, well, I've been in Moscow now for better than 15 years. And I haven't had that to do since here. When I did do any substitute teaching, I used the work that was already prepared by the teacher.
How have your own methods, did your methods change through the years?
Do you feel
that, how did they change?
I think the greatest change was largely strictly memory work. And now it's more working out a problem. Instead of, the book says this, mm-hmm. you memorize that. Well, now then, you're given a problem and you solve it. Whether it's what's going to be done with, I don't know, something, then it was stated there and the answer was given, but now you, work out your...
What I have in mind now is something a little different, is what in your own teaching methods, the way you yourself taught, let's say the way you taught in 1910 and then the way you taught in 1930 or 40 when you're teaching in Orofino, let's say, how are you teaching in the later years? Did you find your own ways of teaching change?
Yes.
Did you discipline the kids less? Did these things change?
No, that's one thing I'm afraid I was. I was pretty cross, I guess.
Well, what did change in the way you taught?
Well, now, in discipline or in.
In just in your own methods, what?
Well, I think the greatest thing that I said was memory work.
You yourself taught less memory work.
No, later. But in the beginning, it was memory work. Large, so much of it was. And no, you got away from that, I think, from memorizing what the book said.
What kind of regulations did you feel under? I know you showed me this. This courting allowed once a week and not at all for a female teacher, but you said that you didn't have to do nearly all these things weren't written in your contract, but what were you expected to do as a teacher in Minidoka? What do you think the community expected of you as far as your out of school?
Pretty rigid. A teacher was looked to as the example, whether it was a man or woman. And if a child saw a man smoke, a teacher smoking, "Mother, what do you think? He smokes." "Well, we'll just see about that. He won't be here next year." No. Compared with the liberty, I don't know, liberty isn't the right word there.
Liberalism.
Liberalism is so much greater now than it was even when I was teaching. Of course, it wasn't as rigid as that, but there weren't any short dresses, and there wasn't any wearing of the women didn't wear pants. If they had to ride to school, now if they lived so far in the winter time, they could wear overalls or jeans, whatever you call them, and then take them off. But they didn't keep them on in the school. They took them off with their coat and their mittens and their caps, hoods. They were hoods then. They took them off and hung them up just the same as did the other thing. They didn't wear the overalls and pants during the day. But they could wear them home and could wear them to school, but they were taken off as soon as they came to school.
Could you go out on a date as a teacher? Did they allow you to?
Very seldom. Yes, I went to dances. I loved to dance, and I did go to dances. Nothing was ever said about it. Now, where I was, I do know that dancing was frowned on in some places, but not all. And I danced, liked it.
Well, I believe that you met Mr. Craig down there at the Minidoka Project while you were living there. Was that when you were teaching that you met him?
Yes. Of course, you know this, that he was a minister.
Oh, he was a minister.
He was a minister. The Methodist Church down here in Moscow has a window that was put in memory of T.C. Craig, which was the father of Stephen Craig. Yes. And it had a nameplate in it like that. And that's who it was, and that's... And he was working, Stephen was working on the Minidoka Project in what capacity? I just don't remember now what it was, because I didn't know him too well then, and then I was gone away teaching, you see. And so I just, but I know that he was, that was his line. I don't remember just what all it was doing in the way of working on the Minidoka Project.
What was it like living with the family when you were teaching that wasn't your own family? Was it pretty nice living with a family?
I found that they always respected the teacher and was glad to have her and made it home-like. And I always had a sleeping room, bedroom, in other words, but we ate at the same table, and otherwise it was just one other family. Yeah. And
did you pay them room and board from your salary, or was that paid by the school?
That came out of my salary, and the most I got a large sum, $125 a month. Just think of that now. The first school back in Nebraska, when I first began teaching, I received the magnificent sum of $25 a month. That was in Franklin County, Nebraska. And I boarded with a half-sister, so I didn't pay very much board. I think it was $2 maybe $2.50 a month. I didn't pay very much board, but I got $25.
What was it at Minidoka, do you think?
I believe the last that I taught there, I think I got $125. I believe that's what it was. And I think the board was it 15? One place was $15 a month, I know, for board and room. And now, like with these over at Warm Springs, that included a horse to ride to school instead of having to walk. See, I had a horse. Of course, they fed the horse and everything like that.
Do you remember how the project was going when you were down there? Were people really up against the wall? I mean, really close to failure? Or did they do pretty well? How did the people
live? It was very, very difficult. And of course, there weren't too many that settled up later. No, first thing, there was no lumber to build a house, and there wasn't sod to make a soddy house. Now, in Nebraska, there was. But there in the Minidoka Project, there wasn't. And they had to haul their, they made log houses, log cabin, and one of the schools that I taught, no, that was yellow, was a log school house built out of logs. And that, they had to be hauled from many miles, from wherever they could find trees that was growing, that they could cut and use and make the logs.
How do you think it compared in your mind when you when you came up here and saw Moscow and what this country was like up around here compared to the Minidoka country down there?
Well, it looked pretty good to me because from a barren desert, a semi-desert, region by the time, there were settlers on the project, you know, by then, and there was little cabins here and little houses here, and Paul had a store by, and Hayburn, one town I believe it no longer exists, named for Senator Hayburn, and they had to be a store where you could, a general store, groceries and a few yards of material and so forth.
But Moscow looked.
Moscow looked like quite a sizable place. Yes. Yes, Moscow looked like quite a little city compared with with the Minidoka Project.
What do you remember the town as being like then?
Well, Moscow, you mean? Well, it was, of course, small compared to what it is today. No tall buildings, no, of course, it had the Methodist Church. There was a Methodist Church here in Moscow, and a Catholic Church, of course, and I believe there was an Episcopal church. There wasn't a church building, but they had the services. And but the Methodist church had a building.
Were these churches very, very important in the social life of the town then?
Yes, definitely.
Can you describe a little bit of what people did around the church then?
Well, they had churches services in the morning, and again in the evening after the whole. Yes, indeed, Sunday evening you went to church just the same as you did in the morning. And they had Sunday school in the morning. They had Epworth League. It was an organization. The Methodist Church was called the Epworth League, for the young people. That was the young people. It was called the Epworth League. That was a strictly Methodist name, and they had prayer meetings on Wednesday night, and people attended them. If you weren't there, how come you weren't out to prayer meeting last night? What happened? You were supposed to attend these things. Yes, religion, I think, held a much larger place or much larger part of the individual life then in Moscow. There were the two things. You were a church member or you weren't. See. Of course, there were Catholics here too in Moscow, but the Methodists was the largest at that time.
Well, were the Methodists closely knit as a group? Were they close to each other in their personal lives?
Yes.
Besides going to church together?
Well, yes, because that was the focal point of their meeting. That was the big social activity that they could have.
Can you remember some of the responsibilities that Stephen's father had as the Methodist minister?
Well, yes. Of course, he was an ordained minister. He preached on Sunday morning and again Sunday evening. And he had the prayer meeting. Of course, he presided at, had funerals and weddings. And sometimes, you know, married in the church or married in the home. Yes, he, and always tried to go and see the real sick ones, you know, and be with them. Maybe oftentimes he was called to be with them when the family felt that the death was near, while they wanted the minister there, and that was another thing that he had to do.
Did many people seek advice and counsel from him?
They seem to these days. Yeah, they do. I just don't know.
What kind of a man was he? Do you remember? Can you describe him to me, and tell me what he was like?
Well, he was a medium-sized man. I would say he's a little larger and heavier set than you are. And now the awful things, he wore a beard in those days. Sometimes. Yes, I remember him as having a beard. But not long hair, that is real long. But no, his hair was always cut.
And what was he like?
Now, in stature, he was... I'd say 160 pounds. He was not. He was not a large man. No, he was not.
Was he? What I'm really wondering, trying to get after, was he a man that people could talk to easily, or a man that was sort of forbidding?
Stark-shirt? No, he was easy to talk to. Yes, he was always ready to tell you what you could do or what you ought to do, and. That'd be a better thing if you do this or that. He was ready to do that.
Do you think he was a... was he very inspired by his religion?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yes, I think so. Yes, it was his life. It was all there was to live for. It was life and all the life that there was, as far as he was concerned. He's buried out here. Now, I'll go back a little farther since you're asking about him personally. He was a lieutenant in the Civil War. He was, what do they call him? Well, anyway, minister in the Civil to the people of the North in the Civil War. He was in that. I think of the word that...
Oh, it's not important. I know what you mean.
He was a
minister to the
but,
troops.
As that, but he was also a minister in the... Well, he was in prison. That awful prison that they had. He was there for a while.
Andersonville?
Yes, he was captured in the Andersonville prison for a while. And one thing that he delighted in telling, rice was cooked and put in a trough. And then they could go and they had a dish, and they could dish out rice from this trough, and that's what they had to eat while they were there. One of the staple things. And one of the things that he remembered so well, he had befriended and helped a little Indian boy. And when the Indian boy found out where he was and that what he was having to eat, just rice served up in a trough, why, he went out and he found a meat crackling. A piece of pork, skin of pork, you know. He found that, and and that and brought that to T.C. Craig. And that was, in his mind, just a wonderful thing to have a piece of a crackling of meat to eat with the rice. And he's told that many times, about the Indian boy finding a crackling for him.
Do you remember his sermons at all, what they were like?
No, nothing. No, I don't have, and I don't have any anymore. Not at all. I never heard him preach very often anyway. And all of his sermons and everything, Stephen had them, but when the house burned, everything like that burned, and so we just haven't any record of them at all. None of the original. It's too bad, too, but fire does destroy everything, and that's what happened. Do not have any.
Did he talk about his Civil War experiences very much?
No, he didn't, unless he was questioned. No, he did not. He just, of course, was against war, so that he just didn't feel to that he wanted to dwell on them or to talk about them. I never heard.